coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware takes the next step toward making offshore wind part of the state's energy picture.
It probably would be accurate to regard this bill as really where the rubber hits the road. This is how it happens. This is a major piece of Delaware's climate strategy.
Contributor John Hurdle examines new legislation to create a framework for purchasing offshore wind. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn why birding is a big deal in the first state. Arts Playlist introduces us to the Delaware Division of the Arts Master Fellow Award winner. And History Matters tells us about a book highlighting lesser-known aspects of Delaware's past. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The first state takes another significant step toward purchasing some electricity from future offshore wind farms. Last December, DENREC released a report calling on the General Assembly to pass a law authorizing the state to procure offshore wind power. That legislation, the Delaware Energy Solutions Act of 2024, was introduced late last week with hopes of getting it passed before the end of this year's session. Contributor John Hurdle takes a closer look at the legislation and the chances it will be approved in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to discuss his reporting. So let's start with the legislation itself. John, what does the Delaware Energy Solutions Act of 2024 do?
Well, first of all, it directs the State Energy Office to seek bids from the offshore wind industry to supply electricity from an offshore wind project, either on a standalone project that Delaware would do, or either that or in cooperation with other states. And this project should be between 800 and 1200 megawatts. So that is roughly equivalent to various other offshore wind projects off the Atlantic coast. And it would contribute about one third, at least one third of Delaware's energy needs. That the bill would also require bidders to submit data on a whole host of non-price criteria that would kind of accompany their bids. And so those would include how their project would help Delaware's climate goals, how the absence of fossil fuels would help public health, how it would help the economy, the number of jobs created, and impacts on transmission. A couple of other crucial aspects to this bill are that it limits the cost of any of these bids to 110% of something called the Delaware benchmark price. And that effectively is the average price that ratepayers have been paying for electricity over the previous 3 years. And then the other thing is that it builds in what's called an escalator, meaning that developers or whichever developer is finally selected is allowed to increase their costs by 2% a year as an offset to inflation.
So, John, why is creating this procurement process significant? How does it fit in with Delaware's overall efforts to combat climate change?
Well, what this bill does is provide a legal framework for how Delaware would commit to buying offshore wind power. And this is really a significant move, and it's kind of the implementation of a series of moves that the state has done during the last several years. I guess those really started with something called the Climate Action Plan, which was published by the Carney administration, which set out its goals to move to a clean energy economy. And in fact, the ultimate goal of that is to establish something called net zero, in other words, to have net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And that framework by the administration was backed up by the legislature last year, which passed the Climate Solutions Act, which was essentially giving legal backing to the administrative framework. And now we've got the bill that would provide the mechanism by which the state commits to buying a very significant amount of emissions-free power.
So, John, you mentioned Governor Carney, and he said in this bill being introduced that this can get Delaware into the offshore wind playing field in a fiscally responsible way. What are some of the ways that you mentioned that the bill does seek to make this process more fiscally responsible?
Well, I think the first thing to mention is that this provision that it sets a limit or the cost of power generated from the project to 110% of this benchmark price, which, by the way, is a new measure that would be established by the bill. So that's an attempt to ensure that Delaware ratepayers don't pay too much for power that's generated by an offshore wind farm. And then the other part of this fiscal responsibility idea is that it provides what is generally seen as a kind of a conservative price escalator. This 2% figure that we mentioned before, of course, that is actually below the national rate of inflation at the moment. And so that would be another way of holding down any excessive price issues that might arise.
So, John, in your piece notes, and you've mentioned this previously, that up and down the East Coast, state commitments to buying offshore wind power are crucial to industry investment in planned wind farms. How is Delaware's approach in this bill likely to be received by industry players?
Well, the indications that I've heard from this, Tom, is that the industry is hot to trot. I talked to an organization called MAREC, the Mid-Atlantic Renewable Energy Coalition, which is essentially a trade group for developers in the renewable energy space, including offshore wind. And what I was hearing from them is that there is a lot of interest amongst developers for getting into the Delaware market. I mean, clearly, developers are interested in new markets for offshore wind energy. And as everybody knows, Delaware is the very last Atlantic coast state that does not have an official commitment for buying offshore wind power. In addition to which, there are a number of offshore so-called lease blocks that the federal government will be auctioning off, seeking buyers for this year. And so that's an opportunity for the offshore wind industry. And if the companies acquire those leases on those blocks and Delaware finally agrees that it wants to buy a certain amount of offshore wind power, then that's obviously a market for the industry.
So based on what's happening elsewhere along the East Coast, are there any concerns about Delaware's approach to this compared to other places?
Well, one concern I have heard is it's a question of whether this 2% escalator is this inflation allowance, if you like, is going to be sufficient for the industry. Clearly, national inflation has been a problem over the last several years. Whether it's coming down fast enough now to make offshore wind developers comfortable with a limit, with this 2% limit on annual increases, on their annual cost increases, I think that's a question. I was speaking with Chris Olith, who's the head of the University of Delaware's Special Initiative on Offshore Wind, and her opinion was that this point may not be a death knell for the bill, but it may be that there's some concern about this in the industry. The other point that she raised was that there may be an issue with the requirement that non-price elements are factored into whatever bids come forward here, because there's a concern that factoring in things like workforce development or other non-price factors might make offshore wind look more expensive than it really is.
The bill sponsor, State Senator Stephanie Hansen, has worked throughout this process to engage stakeholders as the bill is crafted. Are those stakeholders largely on board with this?
Well, there does appear to be broad support. The bill was crafted with input from the Carney administration, from DENREC, from various regulators, including the Public Service Commission. And many of those parties are represented on the Energy Stakeholders Group, which has been brought together by Senator Hansen as kind of a forum for discussing these issues. And a couple of discussions that I've been listening to that group indicates that there's pretty good support. It's also worth mentioning that there appears to be quite strong public support on this. In the first legislative hurdle, if you like, that this bill faces in the Senate Environment Committee this week, about 27 members of the public stood up, and all but four of them urged the committee to go ahead and advance this bill. saying, well, you know, Delaware really needs to do this and needs to do this soon. And in fact, the committee did advance the bill.
So based on that first hurdle being cleared, tell me a little bit more about what lawmakers are saying. Is there any pushback from lawmakers as this bill starts to advance?
Well, the committee did hear from one Republican lawmaker, Senator Buxton. He questioned whether offshore wind is the right response to climate change. He said he didn't deny that climate change was a problem, but he was asking whether offshore wind was really the right response to that. And he proposed that electric bills should have a line item which show them how much of their electric bill was being contributed by offshore wind. I mean, that idea was not taken up by Senator Hansen, but he did raise that. Previously, I've also spoken with Representative Rich Collins of Sussex County, another Republican, and he said that he would be voting against the bill. He considers that offshore wind is too expensive. And he also questioned the competence of the State Energy Office and some of these other agencies that he said that are not elected and in his view are not competent to make these decisions on the part of ratepayers.
So you've talked to a lot of people in reporting this story. Based on all those conversations, what do you feel like the bill's prospects are of passing?
Well, it looks like this bill will be passed. I mean, the folks that I talked to before the bill was actually introduced seemed pretty confident that it would get through the Senate. I mean, the early indications are with the Environment Committee's approval of the bill this week. And Senator Hansen says that she wants to get the bill to the House by May. You know, I was talking with also Dustin Thompson, the director of the Delaware Sierra Club. I mean, he was also pretty confident that there would be no problems in the Senate. He thought that the House would be more problematic. But of course, there is a fairly substantial Democratic majority in the House. And even Representative Collins, even though he said that, he was personally going to be voting against the bill, he rated the bill's chances of passing the House at, quote, better than 50-50.
So assuming this bill does pass, John, is it fair to say the state will have done its part to make offshore wind possible in Delaware? Is this perhaps the biggest hurdle it faces to kind of getting the process underway?
Well, I think so. I mean, it probably would be accurate to regard this bill as really where the rubber hits the road. You know, this is how it happens. This is a major piece of Delaware's climate strategy, and tapping into this very significant source of emissions-free electricity, without which, you know, environmental advocates say, you know, Delaware doesn't really have any hope of meeting its climate goals by the middle of the century.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece on Delaware's offshore wind procurement legislation is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We delve into the world of birding in the first state ahead of next month's Delaware Ornithological Society annual Delaware Birdathon. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Birding is more than just looking to the sky or watching birds at a backyard feeder. The popular American pastime emphasizes conservation of wetlands and wildlife areas that attract and shelter birds. In the first state, known as one of the best places in the country to birdwatch, the Delaware Ornithological Society holds its annual Delaware Birdathon fundraiser from May 4th through 12th to support habitat preservation and conservation. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Delaware Ornithological Society President Michael Moore to discuss this year's Birdathon event and birding in Delaware.
So spring migration is underway, and as we move further into spring, the birding in this region is only going to get that much better. But Mike, when I say birding, what exactly defines it? What defines birding?
Well, I think there are two things that define birding. I think a lot of people appreciate birds, appreciate their color, and like to watch them. But if you're going to call yourself a birder and you're going to say, I'm going out birding, the most important thing is to you want to put a name on every bird. You don't want to just say, oh, there was a pretty bird, or there was an owl, or there was a heron. You want to know exactly what species you're looking at. We call that bird identification. And I think that's the most important part. I think the second part is that most people who go birding or call themselves a birder, keep records of some kind about what they see, whether it's just a simple list of all the birds they've seen, we call that a life list, or whether they keep more detailed notes. And there is a website run by Cornell University called eBird that allows you to keep your records on the computer and share them with everybody else and actually contribute to citizen science that way.
Yeah, Cornell specifically, they do a lot of wonderful work. And the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, they do a lot of wonderful work, obviously in this area. But Mike, I've never gone birding or bird watching. I've known people to. For us novices out there who have only ever watched birds essentially from our back porch, can you walk us through exactly what a typical birding experience looks like? I'm sure what comes to mind for a lot of people is, being in the forest with a field guide and binoculars, or any of the amount of, movies they've seen and what those characters are doing. But what does birding and even, supplies you'd have on you, like what does that look like in this context?
Well, the great thing about birding is you can do it at many different intensities and many different levels. Watching birds from your porch in your backyard is still birding, and a lot of people do that. But what you're really talking about is going out and seeking birds. And so the idea is a place you want to go, and exactly as you describe, you go there with your binoculars and maybe with a spotting scope if there are some distant birds there. And you walk around and or drive around and you try to spot as many birds as you can, and then you try to get good looks at them so that you can identify them and record what species that you've actually seen. So that's pretty much what it boils down to. And sometimes you're looking for birds that that you're trying to find. Other times you're looking for birds that other people have reported, and that's particularly true when there's a really rare bird shows up. A lot of birders will flock to that area and try to refine that rarity.
Well, Delaware is pretty well known as one of the better states and general areas in the country to bird watch. Even arguably the best birding film out there, The Big Year, has some nice first state connections that I was reading about. But why is Delaware a great state to bird watch? And what are some of those best, spots to bird watch here?
Well, the main reason for our reputation is Bombay Hook National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, that is one of the best spots in the country, if not the world, to see birds. And it's really nice because you can drive around Bombay Hook. Everything is right there. You can see most of it from your car. It's a really easy place to bird watch, so that's a big deal. Any state along the East Coast is going to be important because a lot of birds migrate along the coast. And especially in fall, what a lot of birds do is they migrate towards the coast and they go, oh, wait a minute, there's an ocean here. I better turn right and go south. And so birds tend to concentrate along the Atlantic coast. And Cape May, New Jersey is probably the most famous birding area on the coast, just across the bay from us. And that's what happens there is thousands of birds accumulate there, trying to get up the courage to cross the Delaware Bay into Delaware. And so we see a lot of those birds arriving in Delaware, although many of them just fly over us and wave. But it's the combination, I think, of the location and the availability of a lot of good natural areas, with Bombay Hook being sort of the crown jewel. I mean, Cape Henlopen is a very nice place to look for birds. In the spring, White Clay Creek State Park and the other state parks are good areas. In some ways, we don't have as much habitat variety as certainly Pennsylvania or Maryland or New Jersey. We don't have high elevation, so there's some things that we lack, but we're right in that migratory coastal pathway, which can make it very exciting.
Well, what about the birds then themselves? What kinds of birds are we talking about here, or species of birds? What do we usually see here in Delaware?
Well, I think 450 species have been seen in Delaware, roughly. So pretty much everything. Certainly known for shorebirds. Again, Bombay Hook is just a mecca for lots of different shorebirds, including sandpipers, plovers, herons, egrets. A few years ago, there were even some roseate spoonbills there, which attracted large crowds. So there's a great variety of birds that you can find in Delaware. Again, some of the really high altitude species don't breed here, but many of them migrate through here. So you can see a lot of different things. But I would say the shorebirds, the water birds, the coastal birds are what we're sort of people come here to see.
So you just mentioned migrate through here, and as I said at the start of this, spring migration is indeed underway. Is there anything specific to this time of year and with spring migration going on that people should be on the lookout for in terms of birds or
Well, the
bird
big
happening?
star of spring migration are warblers, because we have the wood warblers, the New World warblers are some just incredibly beautiful birds, things like Blackburnian warbler and Prothonotary warbler, and the list goes on and on. And they're, of course, in breeding plumage now. In fall, they won't be. They're a lot more dull in fall. So people really want to see warblers in breeding plumage, and they're singing, which helps people find them. And in a good day, you could see 20 or 25 different species of warblers in a place like White Clay Creek State Park. You've got to spend a lot of time looking at the tops of trees. There are small birds that tend to be high up in the trees, and sometimes they can be hard to find. But that's I think the focus of spring migration. At least what gets people excited are the warblers.
Well, let's transition then to Birdathon. The Delaware Ornithological Society is holding its 18th annual Delaware Birdathon fundraiser from May 4th through the 12th. And you're holding it in support of habitat preservation and conservation. And I want to come back to that piece here in just a bit. But can you unpack Birdathon a bit for us then, and just how it works, and what we need to know about this year's Birdathon?
Sure. So Birdathon works like many other a-thons, like a walk-a-thon or run-a-thon, that you basically, if you want to participate as a participant, you generally form a team, get three or four other birders to join you, and then you go out and get sponsors. And the original idea was, you would pledge a certain amount per bird. And so a really good team could see between 75 and 125 species in a day. So you might pledge 10 cents or 25 cents a bird, something like that. And then the team would go out on one day, and they have 24 hours, and they would try to see as many species as they could. And when they were done, they'd tell you how many species they saw, and then you would make your donation. To be honest, the way it's sort of evolved is most people just make a flat donation to Birdathon in support of a team, because the teams do compete with each other to see who can raise the most money and who can see the most species. But most of the donations we get now are $25, $50, $100, up to $10,000. So that's generally how it works. And just want to put a little plug in. I am the president of the Delaware Ornithological Society. We're a small volunteer organization with an ambitious agenda, and we could really use your support. If you go to our website, which is dosbirds.org, there's a lot of information about what we do, and we would really love to get more support, because that particularly helps us with our conservation agenda, the larger an organization that we are.
Well, then that piece about habitat preservation and conservation, and why you hold Birdathon in the first place. I'm curious, given climate change and the human industrial impact on birds here, can you give us an idea of just how important preservation and conservation efforts are when it comes to birds and their environment?
Yeah, sure. Again, just point out that over the 18 years, Birdathon has raised about $750,000 and
Wow.
preserved almost 3,000 acres of habitat. And even before I became really involved with the Delaware Ornithological Society, I gave a lot of money to Birdathon, because I like events where the money goes to buying land. Because once you've bought land and you've permanently preserved it, that's something will persist into future generations. If you contribute to other sorts of lobbying efforts or passing laws or things, you just never know whether that's going to be permanent. But these lands that we've helped purchase are permanently preserved habitat. And of course, not just for birds, but for all the organisms on those habitats. So we've tried to focus on critical habitats. So the early years of the Birdathon really focused on the endangered red knot, a shorebird that comes through Delaware in May and feeds on horseshoe crab eggs. And the particular area that was important to them was Miss Pillion Harbor. About 4 years ago, we We completed the purchase of all the shoreline at Mispillion Harbor, so that's now permanently protected forever. And so lands are really important. You know, you look at the amount of development that's happened in Delaware, and just even the last 5 years, you know, I think Sussex County is adding 50,000 homes a year or something like that. And in fact, this year's Birdathon, we're working with the Sussex Land Trust on an 88-acre parcel of land in Lewis, which is literally the last piece of open land for sale in Lewis, at least on the east side of Route 1. So it's the Nature Conservancy is another organization I've supported a lot. They do the same thing. They buy land and then they manage it. And like I say, I feel like that's a permanent, tangible contribution.
Thanks to Delaware Ornithological Society President Michael Moore and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we meet this year's Delaware Division of the Arts Master Fellow Award winner, Mark Haggerty. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Division of the Arts is currently showcasing the work of 20 artists awarded fellowships this year. The Award Winners 24 exhibit features a wide variety of work, ranging from choreography to composition. And this year's winner of the prized Master Fellow Award is Mark Haggerty, an award-winning, classically trained instrumentalist, singer, and composer. And this week, Haggerty joins Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel on Arts Playlist to chat about his work and what it means to be named this year's Master Fellow.
So let's start with what brought you to this particular path to music.
Well, my mother was extremely musical, played the piano by ear. There was music in the home. We had a set of records that she'd gotten from Kroger by buying groceries and paying an extra dollar. And I was very sickly as a child, couldn't go out and play very much. And I just sat there next to that hi-fi and listened. And so I got a big dose of the classics at a very, very young age. I'm told my favorite piece at age 3 was the Firebird. I actually think it was the Rimsky-Korsakov Capriccio Espanol, but it doesn't matter. You get the idea. My father wasn't very musical, but he knew that jazz was important. And he had the jazz station on and brought home jazz records of varying quality. And so I got that in my system as well. I didn't assume or presume that I could be a musician, least of all a composer. But I did study music, and I ended up going to the Oberlin Conservatory as a trumpet major. And then I got kind of drafted into the voice department because it happened that I could sing, and I'm a tenor. So I didn't do that very long, but I did sing professionally. I loved the art songs, and I loved the Bach. The opera can be fun, but there's a lot of material I just wasn't interested in, especially a lot of opera stuff I just wasn't interested in. So that wasn't a great match. The whole time, starting in high school, I had begun to write a little bit. And again, I didn't think that I was worthy of that calling. I used to, and when I was a kid, I had likenesses of all the great composers taped up in my room, and it was kind of a chapel, you know? So I didn't think that was for me, but I continued to do it, and I got some encouragement. Frankly, the more I heard of the music that was being written around me, the more I realized, well, I can do better than that. So at a certain point, I took some time off. I went to Brandeis for a year, where I was invited to participate in a graduate level program free of charge. And so that really kind of got me going. And then I had some very good luck in terms of performances and commissions and awards early on that gave me the confidence that, you know, I could do it.
You use sound sculpture as an approach to the work. What is that?
You know, the great 20th century composer Arnold Schoenberg said something to the effect that a piece of music is like a three-dimensional object that listeners can reconstruct in their minds and can only fully apprehend at the end. So obviously he's using time as one of the dimensions of what he called a three-dimensional object. You could argue there are more dimensions, but that doesn't matter so much. But the point of that is that all music has that characteristic. All music has a shape or shapes and a form that unfold over time. So to make a parallel between a musical composition and a visual shape or a sculptural shape isn't itself new. What I'm thinking about is a more explicit, intentional effort to exploit this aspect of music and put it in the foreground. I wouldn't be the first to do this. A bunch of composers, most of them Eastern European, most of them sort of mid-century of the last century, have experimented with this or really delved into it. People like, and these are not household names, but people like Ligeti, Ludosławski, Penderecki, Xenakis, they've experimented with this. I don't know that they've articulated it the way I am, but what they haven't done, and apparently didn't care to do, was to make it truly musical and to potentially combine it with more traditionally expressive music. So that's what I actually want to do with it. It can mean anything from a wash of sound that creates a space around you, or it can be something that tries to give you the feeling of, you know, some of the phenomena of, you know, weather or nature, or for me, some of the thoughts I get when I read about theoretical physics or complex systems. And, it, you know, the feelings that I get, it's very inspiring for me, but, you know, the senses of gravity and weightlessness, acceleration, deceleration, expansion, contraction, twisting, floating, flowing, changes of state. All these things do get conjured up in music. I mean, you might feel some of that listening to a Brahms symphony. In any case, I'm trying to go after this and put it in the foreground, but also combine it with my personal emotional reaction that I have, aesthetic emotional reaction that I have to these concepts in physics and quantum theory and astrophysics and so on. My wife and all my friends tell me, better humanize this before you put it out there. And so I will, but those are my inspirations.
Your work includes the ongoing collaboration on United We Stand with the urban spoken word twin poets, Delaware's Poets Laureate. How did that come about?
Well, United Sounds of America, and that's their title, and I love it, came about because my wife, Tracy Richardson, until fairly recently, ran and did artistic direction a chamber ensemble. And Tracy said, I want to work with these guys. And so I went out and heard them. And she said, we're working with them and you're writing the music. And so the first version of that was actually done by her ensemble about 5 years ago. We kind of felt this could be bigger, should be bigger. And I was working with James Allen Anderson, the conductor at the University of Delaware. And we were going to do some projects and I gave him a listing. And the one I most wanted to do would be to turn this small piece into a much larger production. And he looked at the list and he said, look, we've got to do the Twin Poets. We've got to do United Sounds of America. So that was a given then. We brought in a soprano, we brought in a pianist, we brought in the composer, percussionist, Jonathan Whitney. A soprano, also from Delaware, is Makita Hampton. She sings with the Met a lot. Everything came together very nicely. And we also asked the poets to update the title poem, which is called United Sounds of America. They take that piece and they update it to reflect what's on their minds, what's in the news, and where they feel this country is or where they feel their neighborhood is at any given moment. And they also wrote a new piece to be sung by the soprano, Makita Hampton. And we were all sitting around the dinner table asking ourselves, what do we want this to be? And we turned to Makita and said, you know, for your piece. And she said, well, I think we need something with a feeling of benediction. And that very quickly turned into a conversation about grandmothers and their common experiences with their grandmothers. And that led to a poem about a beloved and very much missed, deceased, you know, remembered grandmother, which is something I never would have thought of, something I never would have chosen for myself to write about. And it was perfect. So that's kind of how it came about. We've recorded it. It came out very well. We're shopping it around to some labels. And we're looking for the next opportunity for performance.
Your piece, Woodland, is inspired by the return of forests in Israel, a symbol of hope for the region and the world. And all the instruments in Woodland, the strings, woodwinds, the solo percussionists, marimba, woodblocks, they're all made primarily of wood. Tell us more about that.
So Woodland was a commission from the Teffen Music Festival in Israel a few years ago. I knew there were going to be professionals playing and students playing, but there wasn't going to be a lot of rehearsal time, and so I needed to write something playable. I also knew the soloists were absolutely world-class. I had a piece in mind called Woodland, and I was in the car with Tracy. We were on the New Jersey Turnpike and talking about this commission, and I said, you know, I really wish I could write Woodland for this, but, you know, what do woodlands have to do with Israel? So she got on her phone and she said, well, guess what? Since its inception, Israel has been planting trees, and the land occupied by Israel today supports more woods than it did in the year 1900, which is very much an exception in the world. So that, suddenly it made sense. So the three movements are life force, which kind of speaks to the power of life and its ability to regenerate. The middle movement is nocturne, and the last movement is rebirth. All of the percussion instruments are wooden, you know, and all the instruments are wooden. So we don't have any flutes or any brass. It's oboe, clarinet, bassoon, strings, and wooden percussion instruments.
Thanks to Delaware Division of the Arts Master Fellow Award winner Mark Haggerty and our Carl Engel for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And The Green wraps up next with History Matters, which highlights a book focused on some lesser-known aspects of Delaware's past. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. First State historian and author David Tabler has written a new book about the unique, unusual, and lesser-known aspects of Delaware's past. In Delaware, from railways to freeways, Tabler offers dozens of stories and historical photos from Delaware in the 19th century, including a first-of-its-kind 1874 peach sorter and the crawlspace in the Corbett Sharp House where Quaker abolitionists Daniel and Mary Corbett hid a fugitive slave in 1845. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Tabler to discuss the book and the people, places, and ideas that have shaped Delaware.
You've written Delaware from railways to freeways. It's the second part in three phases. So rewind things back a bit for us and tell us about that first installment and how each part fits together in your series.
Right. So the first that I did in this three-book series is Delaware Before the Railroads, and that came out in fall of 2022. And then this book came out in fall of 2023. I'm working on the third book right now, which will come out this fall. And this new book will be called Delaware From Freeways to E-Ways. So I'm basically tracing the history of Delaware via the lens of the transportation world. And that's particularly crucial in a state like Delaware, because for the first 150 years or so, the only way you could deal with getting back and forth in Delaware was via ship. And so that's why all of our early towns in Delaware are right on the coast. Lewis, Newcastle, Dover was accessible through the Jones River. And it's only later in the 19th century when the railroads come in, when you start to get towns like Felton and Clayton and Merrydale and so forth. All of these were railroad towns, and they were all built specifically for the railroads. And then, of course, in the third book, I'll be talking about Coleman DuPont and his building of Route 13, which was which of course is DuPont Highway. And that suddenly challenged the railroads to supremacy. Before that, if you had a town, you had to be very close to the railroad so that you could deliver your goods. But suddenly Route 13 opened everything up to trucking, and a town in Delaware could literally be based anywhere that was accessible by road. So that's kind of the broad overview of my series.
In this second part, the book is full of photos and with captions or accompanying stories or what have you that essentially, you know, they take you on this journey through Delaware and what really life was like here in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. It's obviously in the title, and you just kind of laid things out really, you know, really nicely in terms of the railroad, the invention of the railroad, how it, you know, ushered in this so-called, you know, prosperous era in the first state. Can you give us kind of like an idea of what kind of prosperous era we're talking about here?
So the mills came in around the 1830s, right around the same time that the railroad was arriving in Delaware. And the thing about the mills that was so crucial to Delaware's success is that prior to the 1830s, mills were seen as something where you simply grind your wheat for your bread or your barley for your beer. But by the 1830s, engineers were figuring out how to attach hydropower to machinery, to gears. And suddenly, all kinds of industries sprung up in Wilmington specifically, but also elsewhere. Mostly Wilmington because of the Brandywine River and its rapid moving water. And so as a result, you had hundreds of mills that were built literally side by side in Wilmington. And that propelled Wilmington far above every other town in the state. But it wasn't until the 1830s where we had a system where we could deliver those goods that were created by the mills in Wilmington to the mainland. And that's where the railroad really fit in the missing piece.
Would you say Delaware was in line when other states started seeing and regions of the young United States of America, the young country, were they in line with other states when they saw, you know, rail for the first time? Was Delaware ahead of the curve when it comes to this?
Delaware was a little bit ahead of the curve. We actually had the fourth railroad, commercial railroad in the country. And the purpose there was to get goods from Philadelphia. They'd come down the bay via ship, they'd land at Newcastle, and then the stagecoaches would pick up and carry them over land, that short 10 or 15 mile hop to Frenchtown. And from there, they would pick up by ship again, and then go down to Baltimore and Norfolk. So the interesting thing about the first railroad in Delaware is that it wasn't conceived as something that would haul steam locomotives. And that's always a surprise when people hear that. The original railway was meant to elevate stagecoaches because the stagecoach was the way that things were being delivered in that 1830s era. And so they put the first stagecoaches up on rails. And if you think of how railroads are built today, the railway bed, you think of wooden cross ties, but the first railways did not use those. They actually had square granite blocks on which the iron rails were set. Why would they do that? Well, the point was, you had a horse drawing your stagecoach running between these two rails. And if you had wooden ties, the horse's hooves would keep hitting those and tripping it, and at the very least, slow it down and possibly pull it over. And so by setting the rails up on granite blocks, that middle area between the two rails was wide open.
Outside of rail, there are countless photos and bite-sized stories to choose from. You know, you write about why Delaware has older covered bridges, which I found really interesting, and mm-hmm. you know, the background on Return Day, William Huffington's Delaware Register and Farmer's Magazine, especially love that mm-hmm. one too. You have examples of old style graffiti, John Jones's adjustable peach sorter. There's the Corbett Sharp crawl space. You know, you really run the gambit here, Dave. What are some of the most interesting photos or stories that stuck out to you though when you're, you know, putting all this together?
I'm always fascinated by the story of why scrapple is so important to the Delaware psyche. I moved here about 14 years ago, and that was the first thing that made me scratch my head. You know, scrapple is nothing more than fried pork, and lots of places in the world have fried pork. So what is the big deal with scrapple? And so I explore that in the book, and it circles back to this idea of Delaware's cultural identity. So scrapple is made from bits of pork that are not otherwise named, you know, eyelids and ears and just bits and pieces. And so you would naturally assume, oh, okay, well, the name Scrapple must be then from scraps of pig, but that's not at all the historical reality of where the name comes from. And so the name comes from German immigrants to the Delaware region. So they came from the Palatinate region, which is in southwest Germany, where Bavaria is today. And they were fleeing the 30 Years' War. So you can imagine, you know, you can transpose that today. Think of what someone in Gaza is going through right this very minute. You know, they're starving, their houses have been decimated. Well, that's what it was like after the 30 Years' War in the Palatinate region of Germany. And so those people were looking to get the hell out of there and find a better life for themselves. And so they first came over through Philadelphia in about 1700 or so, and they went up to the Lancaster, Pennsylvania region. And then they filtered down, the German immigrants filtered down into our area by around the early 1800s. And so Scrapple was a point of cultural pride to the German immigrants because it represented the fact that despite the angst of war that surrounded them for 30 years, they were able to feed themselves by picking up the bits and pieces of the pig, by the things that were discarded by other people. And so that plays into the Delaware sense of independence. You know, if you look back in colonial era Delaware, we were governed initially by the Calverts of Maryland. So they were, you know, this peninsula was initially deeded to the Calvert family. Then the Swedes came in and they governed us for a while. And then the Dutch came in and they governed us for a while. And the English overthrew the Dutch and the Swedes, but they governed us from far away in New York City, New Amsterdam at the time. And so Delawareans, or people that have lived on this peninsula for hundreds of years, have felt the need to be independent because government is always far away and always not speaking to them at the local level. And so Scrapple represents that ability to make things work despite having very few resources at hand. And that, I believe, is the real reason why Scrapple is a point of pride. It has nothing to do with the flavor or its curious name. You know, you don't find it in very many other places in the country.
Kind of sticking with that same thread, Dave, from your perspective, you know, how does understanding, again, you know, something like Scrapple that almost is a good, metaphor or whatnot for this, but how does understanding mm-hmm. history, like what you're writing about, how does understanding this history inform, you know, Delaware's identity today and how we perceive Delaware?
Well, about a month ago, the News Journal ran an article with the headline, Delaware Lacks a Cultural Identity. I think part of the issue is the fact that our children and our grandchildren are online all the time. They're not out and about exploring the physical terrain around Delaware. And this is not necessarily just a Delaware issue. This is nationwide and probably worldwide. And so I think that was compounded back in the, during the COVID era when kids were just bottled up. They couldn't go anywhere. And so I feel there's a real need to get out and explore what it is, the place that you live in, because there are things about it that are unique to that place that aren't found elsewhere. For example, in Delaware, the horseshoe crab. We're only one of two states where the horseshoe crab breeds in America. The other is New Jersey. And it's an amazing thing to take a kid down to Slaughter Beach or one of the beaches, you know, in May and June when the horseshoe crabs are spawning. They come up twice a day at low tide and high tide. You can just look up and down the beach as far as the eye can see, and you see hundreds and hundreds of thousands of horseshoe crabs. That's a rich cultural underpinning to give to a kid as part of growing up. You know, when they go to Arizona or to Chicago and they talk about that, that's something that those kids don't experience in those places. And so that gives the Delaware child a sense of, I'm from a place that's unique and special. And if you don't do that, if you just let kids stay online all the time and don't take them out into the surroundings, you miss that opportunity as a parent or an uncle or aunt or grandparent.
Thanks to author and historian David Tabler and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.